What an honor to be with all of you everywhere. I can't think of a better story from the Bible to launch into this great series that Crossings commences today than this particular story. This is from the Gospel of Matthew, the 14th chapter. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat, go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the water. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You have little faith," he said. "Why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Many years ago now, my wife got for me a quite creative birthday present. It was a ride in a hot air balloon. So we went to the Conejo Valley, Southern California, met the other couple that would go up in the balloon with us, told them what we did for a living and so. And then we began our ascent. And there were these mountains and the Pacific Ocean on the other side, and it was scenic, it was beautiful, I was inspired, but I experienced one other emotion I had not anticipated. Anybody want to guess? Fear. Because I had always thought of the basket having walls that went up like this high, they only went up to about your knees. It's like one good lurch and you'd be out of there. And I was embarrassed how scared I was till I looked over at Nancy, my wife, and she was even more frightened than I was, which calmed me down a little bit. I could tell because she was standing like this. And I said, "Hey, Nance, look behind you. There's a horse ranch with horses down there. My wife loves horses." So she went, "Oh yeah, beautiful." And about this time I decided I'd like to get to know a little bit more about the guy who's flying the balloon. Because, you know, I could try to psych myself up and have a positive mental attitude and say everything's going to be okay. But the reality is we had put our lives and our destinies in his hands. Our future depended on the character and the competence of the guy flying the balloon. So I asked him what he did for a living, and how he got started flying hot air balloons. I was hoping he'd have a real responsible job like neurosurgeon, and maybe he started flying hot air balloons because he used to be an astronaut, just missed going up into space. And I knew we were in trouble when his response began, "Well, it's like this, dude," he said. He didn't actually have a job. Mostly he surfed. And he said the way that he got into flying hot air balloons was one time he was driving a pickup truck and he had too much to drink and got in an accident. "You know how that goes," he said to me. "Well, yeah." And his brother was in the truck and got quite badly injured in this accident and couldn't move around very well, so he started flying hot air balloons to give his brother something to look at. "And by the way," he said, "if this one is kind of bumpy on the way down, it's because I've never actually flown this particular balloon before, and I'm not quite sure how it'll handle on the way down." My wife looked at me and said, "You mean to tell me we are 1,000 feet in the air with an unemployed surfer who started flying hot air balloons because he got drunk, crashed a pickup truck, crippled his brother, and he's never been in this one before and he doesn't know how to bring it down?" And at this point, the wife of the other couple spoke the only words either of the two of them were to say the whole trip. She looked at me and said, "You're a pastor, do something religious." So I took an offering. Do something. Here's the deal. Every day, we take another trip on this giant balloon around this remarkable sun. You all ready for the eclipse coming up? And I want to do it with a spirit of adventure and confidence, but it's a pretty uncertain ride. And there are times when I wish the walls of my basket were a lot higher. And I can try to psych myself up, and you can too, and say everything's going to be okay. But the real question is there somebody piloting this thing? And are his character and competence such that I can, with confidence, put my life and future in his hands? And that brings us to this story in this series about Peter and the disciples in the boat. Now, just before this moment, Jesus has fed 5,000 people, and it was amazing, and maybe the disciples want to bask in the glory of it because Jesus wants to be with his Father, so he orders them to get into the boat and to go across the Sea of Galilee. Peter, of course, has been in boats his whole life long, but this time there's a storm. It's so strong. Literally, the text says the boat is tormented by the waves. When they get into the boat, it's still daytime, but and the Sea of Galilee is not big. It's 4 or 5 miles at its widest point, and these guys are pros, but after 3 in the morning, they're still on the lake, and they see a figure. They're terrified with the storm. They don't recognize the figure. Walking on the water, they're afraid it's a ghost, and they cry out, and it's Jesus, but they don't know that. Now, a quick word about what Jesus is up to. There's a little clue in Mark. Mark says Jesus intended to pass them by. That's kind of code language in the Old Testament when God would make an appearance, when there would be an epiphany, and he was going to reveal a message to somebody. He had something for somebody to do. They would use that language. He puts Moses in a cleft in the rock and says, "All my glory will pass by you." Or he has Elijah stand on the edge of a mountain, "For the Lord is about to pass by." And then he'll have some real daunting task for them to do. So Jesus here is not just doing a magic trick for the heck of it. This is a key moment. But they don't know. They're scared with the storm and the dark. It's interesting, they got in the boat at Jesus' command. They would have to learn, as we all do, that obedience is no guarantee that you will be spared from adversity. And they think it's a ghost. And he says, "Hey, guys, take courage, it's me. You can trust my character and my competence. You can put your life in my hands." And Peter gets this idea. "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you." Now, why does Matthew include this detail? Why didn't Peter just jump in the water? Well, it's because this story, like this series, is not just about risk-taking. It's not just that God is looking for some, you know, bungee jumping, day trading hang gliders. It's a story about obedience, about the heart of a disciple. He wants people who discern his call in their lives. And so Peter says, "If it's you, just tell me." This is the heart of a disciple. "Tell me what to do, God." Prayed that prayer recently? "I'll do it. Just tell me." And Jesus does. Just one word. "Come on. Come." Now, I want you to imagine the scene. I want to invite you to put your story in this story. How violent is the storm? These guys are seasoned pros with a boat, but they've been struggling to stay afloat. Imagine the size of the waves and the strength of the wind, how dark the night. These are the conditions under which Peter's going to get out of the boat. Now, I would think it would be tough enough to try to walk on the water when the water is calm and the sun is bright and the air is still. Imagine doing it when the waves are crashing and the wind is gale force and you're exhausted because you haven't slept, you're terrified, you're not too happy with Jesus because he made you get into the boat when you didn't want to, and now he's going to say, "Get out." These are the conditions that Peter faces. What do you choose, the boat or the water? The boat is safe. The boat is secure. The boat is comfortable. And the night is dark, and the sea is rough, and the wind is strong. There's a storm out there. And if you get out of the boat, whatever your boat is, there's a real good chance you're going to sink. But if you don't get out of the boat, whatever your boat is, there's an ironclad certainty you will never walk on the water, because here it is, guys. If you want to walk on the water, you got to get out of the boat. I believe something, someone inside us tells us that our life, your life, is about more than just sitting in the boat. You were made for something more than merely to avoid failure and risk. Something inside you wants to walk on the water. We might use that, as I think Matthew does here, as a picture of leaving the comfortable routine existence that we all just get used to and doing something together with God that we could not do apart from God's power in our lives. That's what Quit Playing It Safe is about for you. So let me ask you another question to make this story a little more personal, help you put yourself in it. What's your boat? Your boat represents safety and security to you apart from God. Your boat is whatever you put your trust in, especially when things get stormy. Your boat is what keeps you comfortable enough that you don't actually want to get out there again on the waves with Jesus. And if you want to know what your boat is, your fear will tell you. Just ask, what would produce fear inside me if I had to let go of it, if I had to give it up, to leave it behind in order to quit playing it safe and actually step out in faith? Maybe it's your job. Maybe your job's okay. Maybe it's pretty safe, but it's kind of stagnant, and you know it is, and you're kind of haunted by this sense that there is something else out there that God is calling me to do. Maybe it's a ministry to get involved in where you know you could serve other people, but it would stretch you, it would challenge you. Maybe it's a relationship. You're in a relationship right now and you know it doesn't honor God. You know it's not healthy. It's not making you grow in the right way, but you're afraid if you break it off or if you have an honest conversation about it, there's gonna be pain and you don't wanna face that. Maybe it's money. Maybe you're kind of sitting on some money and God could use it to do things, to bless people, but you don't want to let go of it. Maybe it's security. Maybe it's just avoiding pain. Years ago, when Nance was pregnant with our first child, we went through Lamaze class, and I don't know if they still have Lamaze classes, but back then, when you went through Lamaze, they would not allow you to use the word pain. They would not acknowledge that a woman might experience pain during childbirth. We just use the word discomfort. You might experience some discomfort. So eventually the great day came. Nance went into labor, and it went on for more than 12 hours, and it was very difficult because we found out, that the baby was actually turned like 180 degrees the wrong way, so that the hardest part of the baby's head was pressed against the most sensitive part of Nancy's spine, and every contraction was just agony. The worst moment was, towards the end, the doctor physically reached his hand inside my wife and wrenched the baby's body 180 degrees around inside her. And my wife let out a yell like I had never heard in my life. And I'm the coach. I knew I had to say something. So I said, "Dear, are you experiencing some discomfort?" And she gave me a very non-faith-based response, and things got kind of ugly after that. But here's the deal. If your goal in life is to live a comfortable, pain-avoiding life, you got born into the wrong species. You shouldn't have chose being a human being. You got born into the wrong world. Well, Peter decides to get out of the boat. And the other disciples are all watching him. You know, Peter shoots off his mouth a lot. And so just picture now. Just put yourself in the story. He's holding on to the boat, white-knuckling. Puts one foot over the side, puts the other foot over the side, takes a deep breath, lets go of the boat, and begins to walk on the water towards Jesus, doing what he could never do in his own power. And for a while, I think it's like there's only Jesus and Peter in the whole world. And Peter is just beaming. Like a little child taking their first steps. Look at me, mommy, look at me, daddy. And Jesus is just thrilled. Like master, like discipleship. See, this is a story about disciples. And then it happens when he saw the wind. He was afraid. He takes his eyes off Jesus and he said, "What was I thinking? What in God's name am I doing? I must have been out of my mind." And he starts to sink. Now, externally, nothing's changed. The night's just as dark, the sea's just as strong, wind's just as powerful. The only thing that's happened, of course, is Peter's focus has shifted from his Savior to the storm. Where are my eyes? We all know what it's like to see the wind. You start a new adventure, and you want to do this with God, and you're full of hope and confidence and joy. Could be a new dream, a new ministry, a new marriage, a new school, a new job, new work, new adventure, new giving. And then reality sets in, and there's problems, and there's opposition, and there's obstacles, and there's dangers, and there's risk. I didn't see this coming. Because of the wind, some people decide, I'm never going to leave the boat. But here's the deal. There's no guarantee that it's going to be safer in the boat. Eileen Guder wrote this. I love this quote. You can live on bland food so as to avoid an ulcer. Drink no coffee, tea, or stimulants in the name of health. Go to bed early. Stay away from nightlife. Avoid all controversial subjects so as to never give offense. Mind your own business. Avoid involvement in other people's problems. Spend money only on necessities and save all you can. You can still break your neck in the bathtub and it will serve you right. Larry Loudon is a scholar who has spent a long time studying risk management. And he says, our culture is so fear-ridden that we suffer from what he calls risk lock. It's like gridlock, only we just get paralyzed by anxiety and fear. And he summarizes this field with 19 principles. The first one is the most memorable and the simplest. Everything is risky. Life is risky. There is no way to eliminate risk and remain alive, let alone being a disciple of Jesus. You can decide, I'll never get out of bed, he says, and then become one of the 500,000 Americans who go to ER every year because they got injured getting out of bed. Nassim Taleb has written a book called Anti-Fragile. And he says, there are certain systems that not only can withstand shock and disorder, it actually makes them stronger. They get weaker if they don't experience it. And by the way, your body, your bones are that way. Your muscles are that way. Jonathan Haidt is a psychologist, has written a book about the anxious generation, says, in our day, in the external world, we tend to overprotect our children so much, it actually makes them over anxious because to build immunity to anything requires a certain level of exposure and risk. So if I'm going to follow Jesus, you know, life with God is actually anti-fragile. We also rejoice in our sufferings. Really? Because suffering produces character, endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint. And this brings us to a part of this story that you will not like. I don't like it much myself. The choice to follow Jesus is a choice to experience the constant recurrence of fear. You see it in this story. The disciples get in the boat, there's a storm, they're afraid. They deal with that. Jesus comes to them. They don't recognize him. They think it's a ghost. They're afraid. He says, don't be afraid. Peter takes a deep breath. Okay, command me to come to you. Jesus does. Peter sees the wind. He starts to sink. He's terrified. Jesus rescues him. Do you think that's the last time Peter would ever be afraid? This is just the beginning. This is a deep truth of walking on the water. Every time I want to grow, I have to go into new territory. And that means I will have to take new risks, new chances. Every time I do that, I will experience more fear. The fear will never grow away. Never, ever, ever go away. Isn't that great news? Yeah, you're excited. I can tell. You're thrilled to hear about that. The decision to follow Jesus and grow always involves choice, risk, and comfort. And that means the choice to be a follower of Jesus means you must renounce comfort as your ultimate value in life. And that's sobering news to us because we are into comfort. The name of the best-selling chair in America today, anybody want to guess? Lazy Boy. Not Worker Boy. Not Risky Boy. Nobody buys a chair called Risky Boy. I think I'll sit in that for a while. Lazy Boy. We just want to immerse ourselves in comfort. We have all kinds of language around this. I just want to go home and veg. make myself as much like a vegetable as humanly possible, because vegetation is not known for risk-taking. Preferably, I'll do that in front of a TV, and we have language for that also. That's couch potatoes in their Lazy Boys. And you might think of the 11 disciples in the boat as boat potatoes. They were following Jesus, but they didn't want to follow him that far. A lot of people in churches are what might be called pew potatoes. Not in here, because you, wherever you are right now, you don't have to sit in a pew. In this room right here, these are nice, comfortable chairs, because pew would be too much work to sit in, wouldn't it? The old guys in the chapel at 8:30, they got to sit in pews, but here, we got Lazy Boys in this room. I digress. Anyway, we're all into comfort a whole lot, and Jesus is still looking for people that will get out of a boat. Peter does, and he starts walking, but then he sees the wind, and he gets afraid, and he starts to sink. And the question is, did Peter fail? Did he fail? And before I get to that, I want to make an observation, because failure is such a powerful dynamic in our day. Alain de Botton's a wonderful writer, philosopher. He notes that a couple centuries, we used the word differently. Then people would say, I made a failure. Today, we would say, I am a failure. We didn't used to use that kind of language. It's part of life. Failure is not an event. Failure is a judgment about an event. It's a way we think about outcomes. Jonas Salk, the great scientist, developed 200 unsuccessful attempts to vaccinate against polio before he found one that worked. Somebody asked him once, how did it feel to fail 200 times? Salk said, I never failed 200 times in my life. I was taught not to use the word fail. I just discovered 200 ways how not to vaccinate against polio. Somebody asked Winston Churchill once, what most helped you, prepared you to lead, alone for a while, England against Adolf Hitler and Nazi Germany? And Churchill said, it was the time when I had to repeat a grade in elementary school. And they said, you mean you flunked a year of school? Churchill said, I never flunked anything in my life. I was given a second opportunity to get it right. Okay? Salk, 200 unsuccessful vaccination attempts for polio. Was Jonas Salk a failure? No. Winston Churchill had to repeat a grade in what we would call elementary school, for crying out loud. Was Winston Churchill a failure? No. I live in the Bay Area where we get to watch the Golden State Warriors play basketball. The Warriors have won 4 NBA titles while I've been out there. Now, to do that, they had to steal one of the great basketball players of all time, Kevin Durant, from the Oklahoma Thunder, and cheat Oklahoma City out of NBA titles. Were the Golden State Warriors failures? Yeah, probably so. Probably so. Did Peter fail? Well, yeah. I mean, his faith wasn't strong enough. He didn't keep his eyes on Jesus. He sank. He failed. Here's what I think. I think there were 11 bigger failures sitting back in the boat. That's what I think. They failed quietly. They failed privately. Their failure went unnoticed, unobserved. Nobody criticizes them. Peter gets a lot of criticism over the centuries for this. Only Peter knew the shame of public failure. And I know, that hurts. But only Peter knew two other things. Only Peter knew the glory of walking on the water. He alone knew what it was to be held up by God to do something he could never do on his own. And I bet he carried that with him to his grave. I think you ever experienced that, you never forget it. And only Peter knew that when he sank, Jesus would be wholly adequate to save him. He had a shared moment with Jesus that none of the other 11 had, they couldn't because they never got out of the boat. So, my question today is, now how about you? When is the last time you got out of your boat? Now, I invite you to just let God talk to you. Just have the heart right now that Peter had. God, command me. When is the last time you did that? Maybe there was a time in your life when you were kind of like Peter, command me, and you got out of the boat on a regular basis, but somewhere along the line, somehow, things just got kind of comfortable. Maybe you have a real nice boat. It's got deck chairs and padding and stabilizers, and it's a really, I get it. But there's no life there. And I don't care where you are. I don't care your job, incarcerated, real comfortable. God's got something for you. I think about this church. I was reading this week emails that Marty and I started exchanging years ago. Marty talked about how decades ago, he would just kind of wonder, am I inadequate? Is this church going to be too much? And he said he had just enough faith to ask God in those days that one day, by God's grace, Crossings might reach as many as 200 people. And you think about what God has done here. Okay, that's getting out of the boat. I'll tell you my favorite story about this. Now, you put yourself here. There's a man named Doug Coe who had a ministry in Washington, D.C., mostly to people in government, statecraft, presidential prayer breakfast, that stuff. But one time, he met a guy named Bob. Bob met Jesus. Bob wasn't connected. He didn't have wealth, nothing special. He just started meeting with Doug, and he read in the Bible about faith and God and how God said he loves to answer prayers. Ask whatever you will in my name, Jesus said. Bob asked Doug, is that really true? And Doug said, yeah, it really is. Now, it's not a blank check. You got to take in the context of all the Bible. It's not for selfish gratification. But yes, God loves the adventure of answering prayers. And Bob said, well, then I got to pray for something. And Doug said, all right, what do you want to pray for? Bob said, I think I'll pray for Africa. Doug said, well, that's kind of big. Can you narrow it down a little bit? Bob said, all right, I'll pray for Uganda. Doug said, you been to Uganda? Nope. You know people in Uganda? No, I just want to pray for Uganda. Doug says, all right, I'll make you a deal. You pray every day for God to do something remarkable in Uganda. And if nothing happens, if God doesn't clearly answer your prayers after 45 days, I will pay you $500. But if God does do something, if God does answer your prayer, you pay me $500. And if you don't pray every day, the deal's off. Sounded kind of weird to make a bet on praying for 45 days, but Bob said, oh, I guess this is what Christians do, so okay. So he starts praying every day, and for like a month, nothing happens. And then one day, he's at a dinner in Washington, this banquet, they're all sitting around a table, and a woman says that she leads the largest orphanage/medical facility in the country of Uganda. And Bob's just been sitting there like a bump until then, but all of a sudden he just starts pounding her with questions. And finally, to catch her breath, she says, man, you're really interested in what I do. You've been to Uganda. No. Well, you know people in Uganda. No. Well, why are you so interested? Well, this guy's kind of paying me $500 to pray. She says, would you like to, as my guest, come to Uganda and see what I do? Bob says, yeah. So Bob, no connection, know anybody, gets on a plane, flies over there, sees this facility, and is just wrecked by the suffering and the poverty. And he comes back, and because he hasn't been a Christian long enough to know that you don't actually do stuff when you're concerned, he starts writing the heads of multinational corporations and telling them, you know, every year you guys throw away millions of dollars of unsold, unused medical supplies, and there's this place in Uganda and there's kids dying there because they can't get. You ought to send some of your stuff to them. And some of them do. And this facility, this is several decades ago, gets more than $1 million worth of medical supplies. And so the woman that runs it gets in touch with Bob again, tells him what happens, that we're going to have a big party and celebrate. We want you to come back and be our guest of honor. Bob says, okay. So Bob gets on a plane, flies back to Uganda, and he's the guest of honor because it's not a real big country, and this was the largest facility of its kind. The president is at this banquet, the president of Uganda. And afterwards, he asks Bob, would you like a little tour of the capital? And Bob says, sure. And in the course of that tour, they see a group of prisoners there. And Bob asks, what's the story with these prisoners? And the president says, well, they're political prisoners. That's why they're locked up. And Bob says, oh, that's not a good idea. You ought to let them go. And they finish the tour. Bob flies back to the U.S. And several weeks later, he gets a phone call from somebody from the U.S. State Department. Again, Doug Coe told me this story. Is this Bob? Uh-huh. Bob, you been to Uganda recently? Yeah. Did you meet with the president while you were there, Bob? Uh-huh. Did you happen to make any statements about political prisoners? Yeah. What'd you say? Well, I said he ought to let him go. State Department guy went on to explain that the U.S. government had been working for the release of those political prisoners for years and had just been informed that they have been released now partly because of Bob. Several months later, Bob gets another call from the president of Uganda. Bob, he says, I'm going to select a new cabinet. I'd like you to fly over and pray for me while I'm selecting who's going to be my cabinet. So Bob, doesn't know anybody, no connection, back on a plane, flies to Uganda, prays for the president. When Nancy and I were in Washington several decades ago now, and Doug was telling me this story, we were staying at the home that housed Doug's ministry. One of the guys there was a member of parliament in Uganda, part of the spiritual renewal that was going on at that time. God, Jesus is still looking for somebody who will get out of the boat. I don't know what that will look like for you. I don't know what your boat is. But I'll tell you this, I'll give you a challenge. Here's the Bob challenge for Crossings at the beginning of this series. You pray every day through the rest of this series, go about a month or so, for wherever it is God might be calling you to get out of the boat, whatever it is that God puts on your heart, you pray for that every day. And if God does not clearly answer your prayers, Marty will pay you $500. Yeah, you're applauding for that one, aren't you? Yeah. No, that's not going to happen, I don't think. But you make this series about this. Like, why would you not do this? And if God does answer your prayer, if you get out of the boat, if there's something that goes on in the world, in your life, doesn't have to look dramatic, then you let the church know about it. You guys figure out some way to tell your own story through this journey. Because Jesus is still looking for somebody who will get out of the boat. I don't know what this means for you. I don't know what your boat is. I know that if you get out of your boat, you're going to have problems because there is a storm out there and you will take risks and you will face danger and your faith will not be perfect. But I'm telling you, if you get out of the boat, I believe two things. One of them is that when you fail, and you will fail, you will fail. Jesus will be there to pick you up. He remains wholly adequate. That right arm has lost none of its power. And the second thing I know is, every once in a while, you will walk on the water. But if you want to walk on the water, you got to get out of the boat. Amen.